first of all, a large a number of them, you know, expense wise and so on, they had better places than other places to put the youth aid person. So they usually brought them back into Vientiane or brought them back into a regional office and got the IBSer out there. And then over time, as those areas became less secure, you know, we started pulling our people out there so that eventually everybody was back in the cities.
And the relative safety.
And the relative safety.
Yeah.
And where...
Because I'd get back to Mummert. Was he in a cluster, or was he a forward area, or neither of the above?
I think neither of the above would really, because he was there by himself.
So two were forward people, no?
No, except he wasn't really very...
He wasn't really forward. Yeah, okay,
he wasn't
all right.
Very far out. And,
all right.
And get a map, and I can show you this.
Yeah. Well, no, as conceptually as I understand the forward area, is that putting a volunteer very forward toward the Patat Lao to win over people in that gray area between firmly controlled and solidly Patat Lao. And it's kind of going hand in hand with the military approach to pacification.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that, in the time that I was there, that really was not being done.
Okay.
Even people like Dennis that were in isolated positions were still relatively close in.
Okay. So the geography had changed so much.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And you know, Dennis was working on this rice project. He was in Bantui, which Mung Nan. Stop that a minute.
Sure. You're gonna get a map?
Let me go get my map.
Okay, I'll actually stop, not pause. There, I got it back on. I think when I turned that off, when you went to get the map, it was to define the forward area versus the cluster and all of that sort of stuff. But one thing, I did ask you if you knew Hafner, though. And did you actually meet the man?
I might have, but he was not somebody I worked with.
Okay.
On any regular sustaining basis.
Okay, one of the problems is, as we've talked both over dinner and then when going through the 68 through 69 annual report, is that I think that a lot of the Laos people that we have seen have been more later, very few of the earlier, especially when a forward area program would have been set up. I would love to find somebody who had actually had some contact with Hafner and could tell me, you know, what the man was like and what was going through his head and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So unfortunately, that's...
not me.
This is a blind one there.
Yeah.
Did you have any dealings with Pop Buell, who still would have, of course, been in country at that time, even though he had long since ceased to be a volunteer? You know, did he have any contact with you, or did
we might have run into each other?
Yeah,
but no business dealings of any sort. And he was doing his refugees, and that was pretty much a all-consuming passion with him.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And I did talk to somebody actually. Come think of it. Blanking out on the name now. Who was earlier, not as early as Walt Coward, let's say, but who had been in veterinary medicine as an Aggie volunteer in a fairly early era, or earlier than that group, and who did, I think after his IVS experience, join AID and work for a little bit with Buell. No, I just wondered if there had been any more contact with him at all. One thing that that you mentioned, and I actually wrote a quote of the word, you were talking about the Lao way of life and the need to get volunteers more toward that. You know, in terms of the vision that you saw the organization should have. First of all, I can understand and agree that with that, but that sounds like a very different. It sounds like it might be hard for some people who were teaching in Vientiane to really identify with or to embrace as a way of life. Because I've spoken to some people, you know, who taught there and who were quite happy with the pool and milkshakes and cheeseburgers and, you know, the whole thing. I mean, how much of an issue was that?
It was something that, you know, I would quote preach.
Uh-huh.
Like any preaching, that some of it will fall on fertile ground and some falls on deaf ears. And, you know, we ever completely cut off any access to American support to the American economy for anybody, but, you know, we sort of informally and, you know, tried to persuade and to show people that there were some alternatives of ways of, rather than going to the American swimming pool, there was a Laos swimming pool that, you know, I would take new volunteers as they would come in the country, you know, if you want to go swimming, you know, come with me and I'll show you another place you can go swim and, you know, have a great time and meet some other people, and, you know, and some people would do it and some people wouldn't. And,
really?
You know.
Because I never heard of the Laotian swimming area.
Oh, yeah. It's a great place.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
I mean, there were, you know, a number of Lao, there was a number of Filipino
mm-hmm.
that would frequent it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was about, I think I was the only American that would regularly be there, and there was others that, you know, from time to time come.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't, I can't remember exactly when they built it, but it was like, you know, in the last couple of years that I was there. So,
okay.
So like 69, 70, or 70, 71, or
mm-hmm,
something.
Mm-hmm.
It was finally completed.
Yeah, but then it would have been a process of changing people's entrenched habits.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and trying to get them to see that.
Because what was important to me to try to get people to understand is that, you know, if you were transposing, you know, your
I remember
way of
one
life,
one person in particular. Okay, I'm sorry.
Well,
yeah.
Just, you know, that you were transposing what you would, you know, kind of your normal way of living in back in USA somewhere
mm-hmm.
to Vientiane, Laos or wherever, you know, that what's really the learning for you, what's really the gain and understanding for you in terms of what it's like to really live in this country.
Mm-hmm.
You have minimal contact and understanding of that way of life. So.
Yeah, I mean, this, maybe I should pause it because it's only my own observation, not yours, but when I heard about the Kilometer 6, the AID compound, I was just astounded. I mean, that's something that that never would have occurred to me. And probably the Peace Corps Philippines administration, had there been an equivalent, would have said, no, you can't go there. Period.
Yeah.
It's just not an issue. We're not going to show you an alternative. We're going to say, no, don't mess with it. You know, and I was always turned off by the AID exclusivity and, you know, weekend bridge parties where no Filipino was invited unless they were, you know, Harvard Business School grad or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was just so stunned at this, and I almost interrupted you because I remembered a couple of people who I interviewed who felt very comfortable about it, you know, that, and saw no reason to change their mind about that. Guy and Dunlap?
John Dunlap.
John Lapp, yeah, John Dunlap. You know, he felt pretty comfortable about that. And thought that there was. He said years later he realized that it may have been one thing for education volunteers who had that right there, but the fact is that people were out in the rural areas, and the less that IVS was equated with the American mission, the safer they might be out there.
Yeah. I don't, that wouldn't make any difference, but I don't think.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, this is the way he saw it, but it wasn't going to change his own mind.
Is he still in Pennsylvania?
No, he was in Cooperstown, New York.
Okay, maybe that's where. He's somewhere up in that area.
Yeah, Yeah, and I was unfortunately in such a rush. I at first was really happy that someone was located there because I've always wanted to see the Baseball Hall of Fame, and got there so late, and then had to get going the next morning so early to see Nancy Ridenour. And I had to double back to Ithaca to see her, and then go on to Brattleboro, Vermont, by night. So I was going crisscrossing the Northeast in one day. And had no chance to see the damn museum.
Well, I'll give you ample reason to go back to it someday.
Well, maybe. I don't know, not just for the one museum.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, there was, you know, obviously a certain amount of tension between those that didn't ascribe to that vision and those of us who did. And, you know, so it wasn't always smooth going, but.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, to my recollection, we never completely put an embargo on any of the amenities. It was more informal, and did not go out of our way to facilitate and make it possible for people to take advantage of it.
Yeah.
But, because ultimately the reality was that we were dependent on that mission. It got us there, it got us home. Got us around the country if we were traveling.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was never going to be a pure way of life. My hope was that people could make fewer compromises, or make the compromises more in terms of supporting a way of life that was closer to the Lao economy, to the American economy.
Yeah.
And some people understood that, and some people didn't.
Yeah, well, I can't understand why that was it was coming from where I was.
Yeah.
It's not an issue. And certainly U.S. Peace Corps was far more linked up to the government than IVS.
Well, except they weren't in situations where there was a civil war going on. More the visibleness and the consequences of that association were probably much more dramatic in Laos and Vietnam than Philippines or India.
Well, yeah, which is why I would have cut off the contact completely. And I just wouldn't have. But anyway, that's only me, and that's only now. But, okay.
I mean, it had been that way from the beginning, so.
Correct.
You know,
kind of hard to turn off the spigot.
It wasn't like it had not been that way and then had been that way, and we were trying to go back to some former, better way of life. It was just, it had always been that way.
Yeah.
From USAID's standpoint, IVS were their employees to do whatever it was that they were there to do. And that was a mindset that, you know, Bob Lovin and then began that process of trying to re-educate and get people to think in different ways, and, you know, continued that. And more dramatically.
Yeah. Well, that's. I'm glad you said that. So you really do credit Bob with starting that movement. Because that's what he said to me that he was trying to do. But whether that was perceived by everyone else, I wasn't sure.
Yeah.
Which is a different thing altogether.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, one thing I've asked people is, was there any point that One point during your interview, you said that even you too were in kind of an organizational maintenance sort of thing, and so you went to the embassy to try to preserve positions out in the field for the ag RD people. But was there ever a point that you thought, or even looking back now, that you think IVS should have just said, all right, that's enough, we've been here long enough, we're not having the kind of impact that we should, so let's just leave?
Yeah, how I finally resolved that, or side I came down on that, is it was very much an individual decision. Organizationally, even given the chaos and so on, that there were a few niches here and there that, you know, conceivably IBS was in a position to do some good for somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And to the extent that we could continue those, why it made sense to keep making that effort.
Mm-hmm.
And but yet at the same time recognizing the limitations of those, and recognizing that that time of being able to do some good for somebody is limited.
Uh-huh.
If you kind of accept all of those things, why not continue? Leaving was not going to, there was not going to be any great moral high ground claimed by leaving at that point, I didn't think.
Uh-huh.
Provided an opportunity for people to have the kind of experience that motivated me and a number of the other people that came with me at that time to kind of get out, see another part of the world, perhaps gain some understanding of how people, particularly people in that kind of a situation, war and so on that was happening, that, just for your own personal development, but maybe there's some benefit to be.
So that was still feasible.
There was certainly the opportunity for personal learning. Was,
mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Was still okay. Yeah.
I mean, that was very, very possible.
Uh-huh.
But it was not the kind of situation that was for everyone.
Uh-huh.
And you had to, I think, have a certain amount of moral ambiguity, if you will. For people that saw the world in very black and white terms, it was those kinds of people could not function there. And a number of them finally just went home.
Mm-hmm.
For those that could see whose world existed in varying shades of gray instead of in blacks and whites, that there was an opportunity to kind of evolve some kind of a way of life, and an opportunity to do something, maybe learn something in the process, and
mm-hmm.
albeit recognizing that there are some very real limitations on what you can do and how long you're going to be able to do it.
And was there the possibility that this would be probably more the education rather than the rural health folks, but that teaching English to Lao students and might have actually done harm rather than good? As an example.
Yeah. I mean, certainly that potential is there. And in reality, it probably, to the extent that people who spoke English and so on were targeted
mm-hmm.
for re-education camps after the Tet Lao.
Yeah.
But had they not had that, how many of those eventually migrated to the States, and had they not had the English, they probably would lessen their opportunity to migrate to escape and to migrate. And,
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure it's all that black and white an issue.
I'm only asking that because, in effect, that question was given to me recently by Dick Hesse up in East Lansing. That's what he began to feel, why should I teach these kids this language when it might work against them in the future?
Yeah,
if that's the case, what am I doing here? And he didn't try to condemn anyone. He said that he was even guilty himself because he didn't quit when he had that realization.
Yeah.
He still stayed because he still felt it was good for him and something might come for a Lao student. But we had been asking people if, you know, whether it was Laos or Vietnam, if there was some point where just pack up, go, leave, for whatever reason that you might either be doing nothing or harmful, either to the local folks or to the volunteers.
Yeah, I mean, a number of individuals certainly made that decision for themselves, but
uh-huh.
organizationally, that it was, I mean, I think more in Vietnam, but less in Laos. Laos was never that political a program as
mm-hmm.
it was in Vietnam.
How come do you think?
I think it's a variety. I think it's the culture of Vietnam, the culture of IVS in Vietnam, that they had people that were much more radical, that they had much more independence, at least my understanding.
Okay, yeah.
That Laos was very tied, I think for many, many years. The distinction between IVS and USAID, I think, was pretty nebulous for long periods of time, and probably continued into the end, at least in some people's minds.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Where the distinction between AID and IVS Vietnam was, most people saw that they were two different things.
Yeah.
Okay.
Very much so. Perhaps the fact that there were two separate teams, as long as there was in Laos, that there was not a unanimity, that the education people
uh-huh.
were, you know, pretty much entrenched. They were teaching their reading, writing, arithmetic, and
mm-hmm.
you know, reading. Learning, reading, writing, arithmetic are good things. And, the rural people tended to be more sensitive to some of the changes that were going on and the impacts of the war and so on. The fact that the war was always much less prevalent in Laos was always kind of fuzzy. It was out there somewhere, but you know, for the most part, people were not really involved.
Mm-hmm.
Where in Vietnam, again, it was much more immediate.
Mm-hmm.
Tended to radicalize you much,
mm-hmm.
much quicker.
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know,
those are three very good.
Some of those, all of those, or some combination of those, could all give some explanation.
Yeah.
I think the fact that you know, the Don Luis and the people that were with him that resigned at the point that they did,
mm-hmm.
you know, it began to stake out some moral high ground that other people could rally around. But in Laos, that never happened. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, the leadership tended to be more figuring out ways to get along, to make the best of a bad situation for as many people as seemed to want to,
mm-hmm.
to continue
mm-hmm.
to
yeah.
make effort.
But there were a few radicals here and there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And
I mean, we did our protesting. We sent letters off to the president, and you know, we were not.
Yeah, I read some that. Yeah. So those are radical acts, though. In a sense. But it does seem that. I've noticed the same thing, that it didn't go to the same extremes. In the last program.
And that was very late, too. I mean, that was probably in the last year that I was there.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to that time, very little had ever been done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and later there would be more. But one time I found some reference somewhere of a group of Lao volunteers who were, I think this would have been after you, well, may not have been after you left, but of IVS Laos volunteers, current and maybe some past, who were also forming a group against people who were complaining.
Sure,
you may not
be
familiar with that or whatever. I was.
Could have been going on. I didn't know anything about it.
I think it was after. Yeah, but I was kind of stunned. Like, wow, that's really amazing. Yeah. Let me get on to a question about about yourself. I mean, from the very beginning of our afternoon, now going into an evening, because we're after 10 here, but you mentioned the reasons why you went into IBS in the very first place. What did you get out of it?
Like, on one level, the opportunity to obviously see another part of the world, to learn about that, to get some understanding of how our government works in the world,
mm-hmm.
A sense of kind of tenuousness and what I was saying when Mummert and Stillman were killed, you know, that that things are not hard and fast, mm-hmm. that there's, you know, what we have today we may not have tomorrow, and so it's important to enjoy that today or to make the most of,
mm-hmm.
of what we have. I think at least initially, one of the things that was a real appreciation for, I was sitting and doing nothing, which I very quickly lost after I got back here.
Mm-hmm.
But
that's something a lot of people would not understand, sitting and doing nothing.
Yeah, I mean, and that was some of my more memorable experiences, just sitting in some village somewhere and pouring rain, you couldn't do anything anyway, and everybody else was just sitting on the porch, so you'd sit on the porch and watch the rain. And
mm-hmm.
you know, not a bad way of living your life. You know.
Yeah, and without a word being spoken.
Yeah, you just sit there.
people would say, boring, but you know.
I think an appreciation for living without a lot of the material trappings that I have slowly taken on over time, but knowing that I can live quite well without having a lot of that stuff. An appreciation for people that are just trying to survive, that I saw, you know, many of the Lao people that, you know, we were working with. You know, they were being buffeted by forces that they had no control or very little understanding about. And yet, you know, they knew they were trying to do the best they could,
mm-hmm.
make a life for themselves as, you know, as well as they saw fit. But I think fundamentally the most enduring sentiment is just a sense of tenuousness about our existence.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The fact that, you know, had Dennis and I not, or Art and I not changed places, he said, great, you know, have a trip, see you.
Yeah.
I'll go up in a couple of weeks, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, that I could have been there, I could not, you know, who knows, there were a number of intervening decisions along the way that, you know, who knows how I would have responded.
Yeah, you and Dennis may have gone off in a different direction, never met those veterinarians who wanted a ride.
Or I may have said, wait a minute, is that something you... I tended to be much more cautious than Art was.
Mm-hmm.
And but I, you know, who knows? You know?
But who knows? Yeah.
You know, so.
You might have had a weak moment. Well, what the hell? We can just think of
run up. They need help. We're here to help. So
yeah. So that's what we're here for. So
let's do it.
Yeah. 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 No, you never know about those things. I had a couple near misses myself. Actually, three, but. We're gonna make this. So those are the things that you got out of it, and all of those things that you mentioned are influences on your worldview and your perspectives and moral sense, from the way I would put it. Is there anything about the IVS Laos experience that translates into your daily life in ways other than the basic core values and seeing how things develop, anything in your work or?
At this point, I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's when I, you know, first started doing some teaching, when I'd bring in some of those experiences and
mm-hmm.
stuff like that, but that's been so long ago that, yeah, at this point, it's up in 20, what, I left in 71, so that's what, 27 years since I've
yeah.
been in the country. So.
Yeah, yeah. It's just some people continue their relationships in a variety of different ways,
yeah,
and others don't, because they've moved on to other things.
I just, you know, I still have, I was at a Lao gathering this summer when we went back up to Minnesota, and just, you know, brought back a lot of the memories of
mm-hmm.
similar experiences of just being with a bunch of people having a good time. And so there are contacts like that, but as far as a day-to-day, you know, just moved on to other things.
Yeah, and there's nothing in the forestry background or the administrative background that you're doing now, because you probably should say what you are doing now.
Right now, I'm teaching as an adjunct faculty in the Child and Family Studies Department. And
this is at
the University of Tennessee.
Yeah, Knoxville branch, or the main campus, yeah.
And also working. With my wife too. Together to evolve or develop a lifestyle for us that's going to be compatible with our desire to pursue interests that we have, more time for leisure, less time for work. You know, that we're getting to a stage in our life where we're wanting to spend less time working and more time doing things of personal interest.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
She's a tenured faculty at the University of Tennessee. We are, at least for the foreseeable future, why, you know, we hope to be able to use that position to evolve a lifestyle where we're having some time for personal
mm-hmm.
development, time for some of the leisure activities that we like, music, and also time for making contributions to the community outside of our work.
Mm-hmm.
As well as time for travel and maintaining, developing connections between friends and
yeah.
so on. So.
Some of the more important things of life, actually.
Yeah. I mean, our daughter is basically on her own.
Mm-hmm.
Still is around a lot, but you know, she's...
Well, it's because she's going to the same school.
Right. I mean, but financially, she pretty much takes care of herself, so that's no longer an issue.
Yeah.
And, it's time for us to develop some of the interests that we had to set aside for a number of years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's an important thing to do. Pause for a second here. Okay, I've got it off pause again, and it's rolling. And I was looking over this sort of thing, and we have covered a bunch, but there's always one thing. What did I fail to ask that I might profit by if I had only thought of asking it?
I think in the time that I was there,
mm-hmm.
that there was a real, on the part of the official, the IVS office back in Washington, board of directors and so on, that there was a real naivete about what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
That
naivete, not just ignorance.
Ignorance and naivete, I think.
Okay.
I mean, the people that formed the organization, that were instrumental in its early years of development, came out of the experiences of World War II and the aftermath of that,
uh-huh.
where America was good, we did good things in the world, there was, you know, we we were the guys with the white hats. And the world that we were inhabiting, at least from my perspective, the world that we were inhabiting, late 60s, early 70s, was a world in which nobody was wearing a white hat.
Mm-hmm.
That the volunteer, depending on one's perspective, could be as guilty of wearing a black hat as a white hat.
Mm-hmm.
And for that reason was a ready target for, you know, anybody that wanted to get the guys with the black hats. And that
no
was
matter what hats they were wearing.
Right, right. And it was not, it took a very long time, I think, before people began to understand that maybe this is true.
Mm-hmm.
I guess so how that impacts on people, I think there was opportunity, you know, maybe even before I got there, you know, had people recognized this and said that this is not an area that we want to work, you know, and pulled the organization out at that time,
mm-hmm.
it may well have had much more impact than it had, you know, in 70, 71, 72, say, well, we're just, you know, we're not going to do this anymore. What IBS has had, because of its association, because of its, at that time, because of its inability to get any funding other than what it was able to get through USAID, I think it compromised its credibility.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly with a large number of people. And, you know, certainly since that time has been, you know, tremendous amount of effort to get funding from other sources and to.
That's still difficult.
So I think the lesson that maybe comes out of that is it is important who you associate yourself with, and if you are too long with somebody, you can sully your reputation such that you probably can never get it back.
Mm-hmm.
And what that does then, I think, is it limits other possibilities, that if you want to be a real NGO that's kind of separate and so on, it may well be very difficult to do that. And I don't, what impact that's having now on IVS and its fundraising efforts and so on, I really don't know. I've had very little contact. You know, I get newsletters and stuff like
mm-hmm.
that from time to time, but I just, you know, basically moved on to other things.
Yeah.
It was a significant time in my life, and absolutely no regrets for spending that time, but it's, in many ways, it's a lot of memories and a lot of good memories as well as bad memories, but I think in large part it's mostly just memories at this point.
Yeah. Was that?
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
It was kind of a rambling. I'm not sure what it was.
Well, yeah, it pulled together a couple of the things that you'd said earlier, but when you were speaking just now, I remembered, you know, chronologically, something that was going on in the IVS Vietnam program at about the time you were chief of party in Laos, and that was that IVS Vietnam made a very strong effort to pursue internationalization, and I've seen the roster for, well, it couldn't have been later than 71, for about like 1970, and maybe the beginning of 71 before they were closed out. And a lot of people there from India, from Malaysia, from Taiwan, from Japan,
mm-hmm.
Philippines, etc., etc., etc. Was anything similar considered or done in Laos during at least your tenure?
Yeah, there were. Again, numbers I don't remember, but there were several
mm-hmm.
non-U.S. Personnel, people there from Israel, England, Japan, Canada.
Okay.
There was some effort, but again, we didn't have a lot of control over recruiting. It was kind of who we would get from, you know, that would get sent down through the pipeline. You know, we would run into people, or there would be people that would be world traveler types that were passing through.
Would join there?
Maybe they've been Peace Corps or somewhere, or they've been with some other NGO somewhere, and were going back to somewhere and pass through Laos and said, you know, this would be a neat organization, so well then, you know, send in an application. And we did not have the capability to hire people directly. I mean, it wasn't, you had to go through the bureaucratic process to.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, so too would have IVS Vietnam. And I'm not sure how that recruitment worked to get people from other countries. I know how it worked in the United States.
Yeah, well, they had Vietnam had former staff people in Washington that were working actively, much more so than anybody from, you know, that Laos had. But people like Mark Lynch and Don Lewis too, Willie Myers, some of those people that had a number of contacts and were committed to this whole notion of internationalization. And, you know, I think had some contacts and did some effort to try to steer more people towards the organization.
From other countries.
From other countries.
Yeah, I should maybe get back to some of those people and ask how that was done.
Yeah, that's more of a surmise on my part than any.
Yeah, but well, it's at least pointing me towards that. But of course, Jim Esser, wasn't he IVS Laos? I think it's Esser, yes, S-E-R.
There's a John Esser.
Yeah, what did I say?
Is it Jim?
Oh, I'm sorry, okay, John. He was in the Washington office too, as well.
Well, yeah, and then he went out and worked with the ADDO, the Agriculture Development Organization.
But I forget when he was in the main office, if he might have been able to recruit volunteers from other countries.
I don't. He would have been there in the late '60s.
In the office.
In the office, because he came back to Laos. Again, I'm not sure, like maybe 68, 69, somewhere in there.
Okay.
So it would have been a couple of years, two or three years before that. Mm-hmm. And he'd been a volunteer a couple, 3 years prior to that.
Okay. But I guess what I was asking, maybe I should ask it this way, that was there a conscious decision to press IVS Washington to send volunteers from other countries?
Yeah, I mean, we.
And how strong? I mean, was this a priority? Said, you know, we've got to, if we're going to have this not be an American organization that's associated with AID, let's truly make it international.
Yeah, I mean, there was a strong push, I mean, verbally, but. How much that really got worked out, I can't remember. I mean, as I remember, you know, it was something we would constantly be talking about. We need more international, but at least in Laos, I don't remember that there were huge numbers. There weren't huge numbers.
Yeah, I didn't think that there were.
A few.
Yeah, yeah. Even though the program continued until 75. And I was wondering if it was an emphasis in the administration in Vientiane versus Saigon, or a decision made in Washington, or what?
Yeah, I don't.
Okay. All right. I've been questioned out.
Okay.
And.
Do you want to see if there's anything in here that?
Yeah, we're going to look through this big packet of stuff, But I'll turn this thing off
okay.
and say thank you very much.